The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution.
Now, the next clip, Marion, is pertaining to, I suppose, Michael Mallon, the aforementioned Michael Mallon, and the ICA garrison that came in from Stephen's Green. They occupied the College of Surgeons, and Liam O'Brien was amongst their number. Now, not only had he never set foot in the College of Surgeons before, in this clip he described the opulence of the place, but there was a makeshift hospital, I suppose. There was a kitchen with very little food in it, but most importantly, for our purposes here today, there was a little fracas, a little set-to in the front room.
In this front room was some portraits on the walls, one of the portraits of Queen Victoria. And some men there already, the windows had been broken, and some men were already had pointed their guns out the windows, I said, no. And just as I was looking at this portrait of Queen Victoria, a youngster, one of the youngsters, we had a lot of youngsters around us, small boys, ripped it open with a knife. Rip! Poor old Victoria with a knife that he had in his hand, completely. And I was the last to lay eyes on that portrait of Queen Victoria, the very last. As I could see, a fine portrait of Queen Victoria as a young woman. And the next thing was, in came Mallon, and Mallon was furious. Who decided that portrait? He said. Who decided that portrait? Was that a youngster that was here? He ripped it. It was Queen Victoria. If I got hold of the man that did that, he said, I'd kill him. Oh, my, Queen Victoria, I said. Don't care who it was a work of art. Shouldn't be done. Is it Queen Victoria you're looking for? Said a voice beside him then. Here's a bit of her. And he held out his leg, and there was leggings around us, his shins. This was a piece of Queen Victoria. And I just gave him a cuff and went off.
Now, by Wednesday, the British forces had decided to concentrate their efforts on the GPO and the forecourt, and Boland's, the College of Surgeons and Jemison's were left fairly to fend for themselves. Now, John O'Connor was stationed at Jemison's, and in this clip, he answers the question as to whether they were tempted to sample the produce.
I think we were all too young. We didn't know how to drink whiskey then. Of my own lads, none of them would touch whiskey. They'd all take a bottle of stout. Then we came across a case with all the foreign labels on it, which apparently had come from Havana. One of the lads said, this looks like cigars. So we opened it up, and he handed out the cigars, and we all lit up, and they certainly were delightful cigars. So that night, we sent round a box of cigars to every barricade. I sent a few bottles to the small whiskey bottles up to headquarters, and I was told that was quite enough. The next night, I got a message from one of our officers to say to send more hand grenades, and I knew what he meant. He sent a few more of these little bottles of whiskey. I think it was a journal called London Opinion, which was published shortly after Easter 1916, that Andrew Jemison gave a statement, and he said these, he praised the men who were had occupied his distillery, that they had done so little damage, and they had not interfered with the stocks of whiskey, that there's enough whiskey under their control to set all Dublin mad. They didn't touch it, but he said the only thing they took were his cigars, and he complimented them on their judgment because they were the best cigars I've ever had in horses.
Now, since Thursday, and Nora Connolly, James Connolly's daughter, had been trying to make her way back from an abortive trip to the north to try and rouse the rising, or a possible rising there. She took 2 days to get back to Dublin, and she takes up the story here on the Saturday when she got back to the north side of the city.
I think it was near Santry that we were horrified to meet a column of British soldiers with a gun carriage and camp kitchens. They're leaving Dublin, I said, leaving Dublin. Can that mean we are beaten? At practically every door in Whitehall and Drumcondra, men and women were standing. There was a horrible smell of burning, very like water spilled on hot ashes. No one seemed to be speaking to each other. Those who were walking towards us stopped every now and then to look back towards the city. Everything was very quiet. The sharp snap of a rifle now and then seemed extraordinarily loud. We went to a friend's house in Clonliffe Road. Two of the girls were at the door. They looked at us, and we looked at them. We were pulled inside, and one said in a voice full of rage, "They're all dead and slaughtered. The few not dead are prisoners." She battered us with words. But all the time she was battering us in her rage, she was busy filling the kettle laying the table and ordering her sister to take off her coats and their shoes. When she fell quiet, I asked, "My father, some say he's dead, some say he's wounded, some say he's a prisoner." I could only look at her. "That's all the news we can get about anyone. That's all we can be sure of about any of them. He's got to be one or the other."
Now, Nora Connolly's father, James Connolly, was in custody, as was Pádraig Pearce, by Saturday afternoon, and the order had gone out that they had signed an unconditional surrender. And via Elizabeth O'Farrell, word got to the College of Surgeons and Michael Mallon and Countess Markowitz, as Liam O'Brien recalls.
Michael Mallon came in and addressed us with great emotion that he had received an order, and an order not only from Pádraig Pearce announcing a general surrender of all the forces, but also a particular order from James Connolly on behalf of his own men and Stephen's Green and elsewhere, that he was accepting the surrender too, and that therefore it was now a matter of discipline, a matter of soldierly conduct to obey this. And he hoped we would take this in the same spirit as we'd taken everything else. Then went on to say that everybody had been wonderful and that he thanked everybody and so on and so on. Then he broke down and put his head down and all began to weep. And there was a tremendous murmur, a tremendous roar all round from the crowd. And the Countess started walking around and said, "I trust Connolly, boys, I trust Connolly. I trust Connolly. He has ordered us to surrender. It's the thing to do now," she said. "It's the thing to do now, no trouble." So we then started to file out and throwing the arms in a heap there in the hall of the College of Surgeons. I remember the feeling of throwing away the weapon. One felt one had gone back to slavery. During the week, with the guns in our hand, there'd been a great feeling of freedom, a most unique feeling of being in a free Ireland, you see, which the holding of the gun in your hand gave us. In spite of the British Army all round and their guns and everything, one felt that it was in Ireland as it ought to be, for the first time in our lives.
And finally, what are the reaction on the streets for the surrendered rebels? Well, John O'Connor and Emily Norgrove remember.
Oh, well, we were in Shiftesbury for a whole week and we were marched up to Kilmainham on the Sunday evening and we were nearly murdered on our way up.
How?
Well, the women, you know, they were drawing separation allowances at the time. They were dead nuts.
Tell me about this. Where did this happen?
Just above Christchurch. They, they were going to call us all sorts of names and were going to tear us asunder only for the soldiers that was guarding.
What were the women saying to you? Can you remember?
Oh, very rude things now. I wouldn't like to repeat them.
They were that bad?
Oh, yes, yes.
But were they suggesting that the soldiers should kill you or anything like that?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they said that. But they were really very angry.
But that night, we were marched out to the North Wall. But the crowd up there around Inchicore were fairly hostile.
How did they manifest this?
They shouted at us and called on the British to bayonet us and that kind of thing. They didn't throw anything at us, but there was a line of British soldiers from Kilmainham at the Richmond Barracks, right down the whole way to the boat of the North Wall. A continuous line with bayonets fixed and close in together, and we had to march between the bayonets. If you stumbled or fell to a foot either way, you're going to get a prod of a bayonet from a British soldier. But I'm satisfied that those British soldiers saved us from our own people.